Hello, John Cleary with you. Thanks for joining me for this Good Friday special on ABC Local Radio. The church is in the news this Easter, but for all the wrong reasons. The scandal over clergy sexual abuse continues to swirl through the church and laps ever closer to the Vatican. This week, the Holy See Press Office released a note entitled Vigil of Holy Week, its subject, The Sexual Abuse of Minors. Whilst the note is a welcome recognition of the seriousness of the issue, its tone is somewhat defensive, stating, quote, "The nature of the question is such as to attract the attention of the media," and "the truth is that the cases that have come to public attention generally took place some time ago, even decades ago." Two paragraphs later, it states, "It must be acknowledged that the number of accusations of abuse has dropped by more than 30% over the last year, and most of them concerned cases more than 30 years old." The document goes on to speak encouragingly of process reforms in a number of countries, including a United States Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People. Well, today, we'll meet someone uniquely placed to comment on the issue and the nature of the church response. Tom Doyle is a Dominican priest and a former chaplain in the United States Air Force with the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. He's also a canon lawyer who worked for the Vatican Embassy and sacrificed a rising career as the nature of the crisis became evident to become an advocate for victims. He's the author of 7 books and continues to work with and for the victims of clergy sexual abuse. Tom Doyle, welcome to ABC Radio.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Tom, you must at times feel like the frustrated signalman watching an unfolding train wreck.
Well, that's a really good analogy that I hadn't thought of, but it is a good one, and that's sometimes exactly what I feel we're in the midst of, a train wreck that just seems to keep on happening.
You first became aware of this issue when you were working for the Vatican on related issues as far back as 1984. Just give us an idea of your growing apprehension, how it developed.
Well, in 1984, a case was submitted to the Papal Nuncio in Washington, D.C., where I worked. Actually, it wasn't a case submitted. We received a lengthy letter providing us the information about a case from a diocese in the southern part of the United States, and the bishop basically said, "We've settled with 6 families who accused this priest of molesting their boys, and everything is fine. It's under control." And a day later, we received another letter in which the same bishop said, "Unfortunately, it's not under control because one family pulled out and are obtaining the services of an attorney, and they are going to sue us." That was my first involvement. My job was to manage the file, prepare documentary responses, letters for my superior, the Papal Nuncio, and also communicate with the people in the diocese as to what was going on, how this was progressing. Well, it mushroomed very, very quickly, because once the civil suit was filed, the prosecuting attorney, which I guess in the Commonwealth is known as the Crown Attorney, had to prefer criminal charges, and that became publicly known. A very courageous journalist, writer named Jason Berry, wrote a 4-part series, not so much on the sexual abuse, but on the cover-up. This priest had been reported to the bishop several times over a 12-year period, and he had been simply moved from one place to another. And in his wake, he left dozens and dozens of deeply disturbed little boys whom he had raped and sexually assaulted. That's what got it all started. And my apprehensions began as time went on, and time was moving very quickly at the time. By autumn and winter of that year, 1984, because of the publicity, it was known then that there were about 40 or 50 other cases in the area that had been disclosed to either media, law enforcement, or the church. And at the same time, one of the attorneys involved down there disclosed to me that while they knew about this first priest, whose name was Father Gauthier, that the diocese was, in fact, hiding, I believe it was 8 or 9 other priests that were doing the same thing, But they hadn't been publicly tagged yet, so they were still hiding them. So you could see that this was a mess. It was a nightmare that was just waiting to explode. And as time went on, two other colleagues and myself, one was a priest psychiatrist and an attorney, and the attorney is still alive, the priest is deceased. His name was Michael Peterson, and the attorney's name was Ray Mouton, from that area down in Louisiana. We decided, and I'm really not sure where we got this brilliant idea, to try to put together a manual or a position paper that the bishops could use to help them deal with these cases, because naively I thought that they probably didn't know about this. This was the first time this had ever occurred, and so they would be shocked, and I was convinced they would certainly want to do the right thing. So we put together a manual. It was about 100 pages long, and tried to get it accepted by the bishops' conference in the United States. And that's when I first began to smell something was wrong. And what was wrong was that they were resistant. They wanted to have little to do with it. They claimed they didn't need any of our help because they knew everything about it. And ironically, at a reception one time at the Apostolic Nuncio's residence, an archbishop said to me, "Tom, just relax about this stuff because nobody's ever going to sue the Catholic Church." Famous last words.
The other aspect of this, another side to that story, and it's the other side that flows along with this story all the way through, is the response of civil authorities in many cases, particularly in that case you refer to in Louisiana, famously linked to the father of Harry Connick, the pop musician, who as a prosecutor with the government was very reluctant to take on these issues.
Well, he not only reluctant, I mean, he was involved in stonewalling them down in New Orleans. In the place I was at, which was a town called Lafayette, the prosecuting attorney there did, in fact, prefer charges. The priest was sentenced to 20 years in prison, and the case did go to a civil trial, and I believe that one family was awarded about $1 million in damages based on the fact that the diocese had known about this and had simply shuffled this man around and kept it under deep secrecy. That was the beginning. By the end of that year, I learned that the bishops in general were not willing to deal with this head-on and accept the fact that this was a portent for doom in the future.
Let's push the story on a little. This story continues to unfold in the United States until eventually you get to the situation in 2002, where you have the Shanley case in Boston. Cardinal Bernard Law is forced finally to accept some responsibility, and people like yourself and others believe that this really did begin to mark a sea change, because not only did you have that happen in the United States, you also had a shift in Rome, where from the reluctance of John Paul II, you had some indication that movement was coming under Cardinal Ratzinger.
What happened in 2002, now this had been going on, as I said, from 84, and I was deeply involved from 84 until 2002. And there were different explosions in the United States and in other countries. In Ireland in 1994 with the Brendan Smith business and the fall of the government, and that didn't get Rome's attention. In the United States in 97, there was a huge trial in Dallas, Texas, that awarded the victims $119 million. That didn't get their attention. And things would peak. There'd be a lot of media attention. Then it would go back to a kind of a lazy, foggy approach to it all. And the church felt that they had it under control and they didn't have to worry. January 6, 2002, the Boston Globe, on a Sunday, published the story about the cover-up in Boston involving primarily John Gagin, who was later murdered in prison, but also what came out in the wash was Shanley and a few others, Birmingham, another priest. What I think was going on then was I think that the whole situation had developed enough around the country that by that time, the deference that is generally accorded to the Catholic Church had worn down significantly, and the horror of what was presented to them in Boston was such that it just started another process that still is going on. It's still going on. And another thing that they did, the Boston Globe printed copies of the letters between the parents complaining to the cardinal and the letters sent back to them, basically dissing them, you know, just ignoring them. And one woman, for example, I think six of her children were sexually abused by this one priest. So that was a major, major difference. And the only reason that the Vatican got involved in June And everything you read to the intro, that based on their recent statement coming out of the Vatican this week, talking about all of this, there has not been one thing done to protect children by the institutional Catholic Church anywhere on the globe. Well, I'm speaking, let's say, primarily in the United States, Canada, Ireland, the ones I'm most familiar with, possibly Australia, but there has been nothing done in terms of background checks, programs, liaison offices in dioceses to deal with victims. None of that would have been done had there not been incredible pressure from the civil courts, from the media, and the outrage of the public, because it was all forced on the bishops. They didn't do anything proactively, not one thing, except issue statement after statement after statement, trying to minimize and deny the whole issue or twist it around so that it looked like it was everybody else's fault but theirs.
Cardinal Bernard Law in Boston eventually resigned.
Yes.
And people thought, here we have a moment when things are now going to change. Yet within a year, you had been sidelined. You'd been an Air Force chaplain, a colonel. You were moved aside, and some saw that as a direct intervention because of your outspokenness on the issue, and also a process that had been set up within the Catholic Church in the United States by the bishops themselves fell into disarray when Keating, who had been, as a layperson, assigned to look at this issue, resigned in disgust, saying that really there was simply just no interest. There was a cover-up going on. That was 12 months after the Boston issue.
Well, it was. Let me just clarify one thing. I was in the United States Air Force at the time. I was stationed at Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany. Nothing happened to me in the Air Force until 2003 in retaliation for this. So at that time, I was still in the Air Force. The Air Force, my superiors, were all very supportive of what I was doing. It was the bishops of the Catholic Church that were not too crazy about it all. But getting back to Keating, Keating was the chairman of what was called the National Review Board. Now, that was created by the bishops. They had to do something in response to the incredible pressure. And that's where the Dallas Charter came from and the what they called the essential norms. They had been shuffling priests from one place to another, and now all of a sudden they had to play catch-up ball very quickly to create ways of dealing with these priests and with the situations. But what is ironic is that they very quickly put into place procedures, mechanisms to take accused priests immediately out of ministry, to try them and hopefully defrock them or laicize them, as the proper term is. But the bishops did not do anything about their role in all of this, about the cover-up, the lying, the manipulation, the intimidation of victims and their families to force them not to go to the press or to get lawyers. They said nothing about any of that. And also, a number of bishops themselves have been accused of sexual abuse in the United States and elsewhere, and it has been confirmed. None of these penal procedures or sanctions that were applied to priests were ever applied to the bishops, and that only the Vatican can do that, but they've never done it. These guys have been allowed to go into a comfortable retirement, sometimes with some embarrassment and disgrace, but nothing like what has happened to the priests. So I think it's important that everybody understand that in spite of the media by the institutional church trying to claim that they have done so many things, recently I saw something in the media where a spokesman for the dioceses and for the church in the United States said that nobody has done more to protect children than the institutional Catholic Church. Look what we've done. And he went down the list. And of course the response is, it was all forced upon them, every bit of it. And had it not been forced on them, had not these things happened, we would probably still be today where the church was and people were 30 years ago. And that would be millions of these victims suffering in silence.
You're on ABC Radio, John Cleary with you. This Good Friday, we're speaking with Father Tom Doyle, Dominican priest and advocate for victims of clergy sexual abuse. Tom Doyle, let's pause and reflect for a moment with a piece of music.
Thank you.
Allegri via Mozart, an extract from his Miserere, long sacred to the Pope and the Sistine Chapel, and this performance recorded by the Talis scholars in the Sistine Chapel at its reopening in 1994. Music for Good Friday on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you. My guest, Father Tom Doyle, Dominican priest and long-time advocate for victims of clergy sexual abuse. Somebody who's been involved in the issue for well over 20 years. Tom Doyle, let's come to the common thread that you've pointed emerges from the way this issue has been handled. On one side, the church in denial, sorrow for the victims, but for the institution, this has not been something systemic, but something that has occurred as individual incidents. The other side of it is the reluctance of civil authorities, particularly in countries that have a very strong Catholic tradition, to actually believe that the clergy are responsible. This culminates with events that unfold from 2008 on. You have the Pope, Cardinal Ratzinger, formally apologising in the United States to victims. He then comes to Australia and apologises to victims. This year in Ireland, a letter of apology. Yet many say that this problem is one that is of Ratzinger, before he became Pope Benedict, one of his making. Let's dwell with him for a moment. In 2001, you reflected quite favourably on a document that the Church had issued at the time under Ratzinger when he was head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which you felt began to address this issue seriously for the first time.
Yes, in 2001, under the Cardinal's signature, a processio, a document containing procedures, was issued to deal with what they referred to as the more grave crimes in Church law, canon law. And one of them was the sexual abuse of children. They mentioned a couple of other crimes, the desecration of the Blessed Sacrament, and I don't have the document in front of me, so I can't tell you what the others were. I think violation of the confessional, but that was the most important one. And what was, I think, positive about that situation was that, first off, I think it was an acknowledgement of the seriousness of the problem. Secondly, they did indicate to the different dioceses, to the bishops, that they would do the preliminary work on a case, and then they had to send it to the Vatican, and they would decide on the next steps, whether they would do the actual trial, so to speak, in Rome, in the Vatican, in the congregation, or refer it back to the home diocese in the United States. The whole thing was still covered in secrecy, and that, you know, a lot of people make a big deal out of that, and I guess I just, you know, I'm so used to it, I just take it for granted. I believe there always has been a need for a good balance, a healthy balance between openness with the people, because it's their church, it's their society, and they need to know what's going on, and the protection of the individuals involved in the actual cases, the victims, their families, and any innocent parties.
Yes, to preserve due process, if nothing else.
And preserving due process is the most important part, but I think when you enshroud this stuff in complete secrecy, and of course the regulation of secrecy had been there in this document and in the ones that preceded it, and that was taken in many ways, it was blown out of proportion by those who read the documents. It didn't forbid the church from going to civil authorities. The secrecy started when the actual process began.
So this is not, in a sense, the smoking gun for Ratzinger.
No, it's not
that
a smoking.
Some people have been pointing to.
No, there has been a great deal of misunderstanding about that document from 1962 and its predecessor from 1922. What I see them as, I don't see them as a smoking gun or evidence of a conspiracy that they all got together in Rome and said, we're going to keep this quiet and hide it. That wasn't the issue at all. Those documents were issued in good faith as a way to proceed to deal with these problems on a procedural level. But I believe the secrecy, the absolute secrecy about these processes is symptomatic of the policy of the Catholic Church at the time. The Catholic Church is almost obsessed with secrecy. I mean, everything is enshrouded in secrecy, and something like this would be, the blanket would be even thicker. And I don't think they know how to come clean and say, we're going to announce to the public, you know, all this is going on. Now, they're trying to do a little bit of it now, but it's still insufficient. I mean, everything is secret.
The relationship between John Paul II here and Cardinal Ratzinger, later Benedict XVI, becomes important because it's seen that John Paul II, in his desire to get the church involved in the world and reassert the church's place, was a little too sympathetic to some of these cases. The case of the Legionaries of Christ and Father Marcel is pointed out as the most significant example of John Paul II dropping the ball and Ratzinger attempting to actually effect some reparation.
Well, that's a horrendous example. I mean, it's a good example, but it's a horrendous situation. A priest named Marcel, Maciel de Golado, was a Mexican priest who founded a religious order called the Legionaries of Christ in 1941. And it was an ultra-conservative, traditionalist religious order with a lockstep obedience, and it was very highly favored by Pope John Paul II. And I believe one of the reasons he favored it was because they constantly talked about how deeply faithful they were to the person of the Holy Father, to the Pope himself. In the early 90s, accusations were made against the founder of sexually abusing young boys who were in the seminary. And this was very ironic because Pope John Paul II visibly favored this man and repeatedly spoke of him publicly as a shining example for youth. And yet he was being accused of being a molester of these young boys. And these seven or eight gentlemen who had all left the order, one of them was a priest, a couple of them had been priests who left the priesthood, but they're all college-educated doctorates in something or other and very professional men, so they weren't fly-by-nights. They initiated this case in the 90s, and they tried to use the church's own procedures. It never got anywhere. It got into the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and it was shut down. It was not tried. It was not processed. It was simply shut down on orders of the Pope. Now, Cardinal Ratzinger was the prefect at the time. He simply had to obey orders. That's the way it worked. But what was interesting is that there was repeated reference to this. It came up time and time again in the media. And then a book was written called Vows of Silence by two authors, Jason Berry and Jerry Renner. And that came out, I think, in about 2006 or 7, which was the story of the Legion. And that kept the case alive. And it's a fascinating book with incredible research. But when the Pope was dying, you know, in his last months, the case was reopened by Cardinal Ratzinger. And, of course, the speculation is the Pope had no idea what was going on because he was out of it. Ratzinger reopened the case, sent an investigator to Mexico. They came back with evidence, as they said, more than 30 but less than 100 victims. And not long after Cardinal Ratzinger was elected to the papacy, he issued a final decision, and that's that they removed this man from active ministry and told him he had to live a life of prayer and penance. The order is in disarray, because since that time they have discovered he not only sexually abused scores of little boys, but he had sexual relationships with a number of women, and now is found as has, and this is certifiable, I mean they found it, it's confirmed, illegitimate children who are now young adults. What was ironic about this is Pope John Paul II knew about the extent of sexual abuse of children by clergy in the United States. They said, well, he didn't know. He's, you know, it's a, the Vatican's big, the church is big, and he never got the information. That's nonsense. I know because I prepared a lengthy, detailed report in 1985 that was sent to him and put in his hands. Since then, information went over regularly from the United States to the Holy See. So they did know. They knew what was going on, and he chose to do nothing. Pope John Paul never spoke out publicly until June of 1993, when he sent a letter to the American bishops. And in that letter, he basically said, well, I'm sorry for the victims, and I'm more sorry for the bishops who are going through this agony. And then he shifted the blame and shifted it to the American media and to our so-called secular culture, and ended the letter by saying that America needs to pray lest it lose its soul. His subsequent, I believe, 11 public pronouncements about this issue all were more or less in the same vein. So I don't think he ever really was committed to doing something about the victims, and they're the most important ones in this equation. He protected the priests. And the only real change came was with Benedict XVI.
You're on ABC Radio this Good Friday. We're speaking with Father Tom Doyle, Dominican priest and somebody who's fought for the victims of clergy sexual abuse for almost 30 years. Tom Doyle, let's have a piece of music, something reflective of the day. The music of Palestrina, The Reproaches for Good Friday. You're on ABC Radio this Good Friday. John Cleary with you, our guest, Father Tom Doyle, Dominican priest, author and specialist in clergy sexual abuse, particularly standing up for the rights of victims over many, many years. Tom Doyle, the focus is now firmly on the papacy of Benedict XVI. The events of the last few months, particularly leading up even to the last couple of weeks, have led many to say, well, look, maybe Benedict did initially want to take issue with some of these things, but his response has still been one of blindness, sympathy for individual victims, but a failure to grasp the systemic reality of what's going on. We've had cases in Ireland where the Cardinal has acknowledged that he took place in meetings which involved forcing people to take vows of silence in the early 1970s, and is saying that he doesn't bear any responsibility, doesn't need to resign over issues such as that. You've had the unfolding case in Germany, or cases in Germany. There is criticisms now of how close Cardinal Ratzinger was to these cases. How close is this issue now to the Vatican, and particularly to the Pope?
Well, I believe it is. It's right there. I think it's always been there. And what we're seeing now is the exposure of it. This is a church-wide issue, and the core of it all, the problem, is not so much the dysfunctional priests. It's the clerical, hierarchical, governmental system. And the question is, why is it that this system has persuaded the men in charge, the Pope and the bishops, to place their reputation, the image of the system, of the ecclesiastical system, above the welfare of the innocent children, of the hundreds of thousands of innocent children whose lives have been ruined by sexual abuse. And when you mentioned earlier that they've said all these cases are older cases from many, many years ago, that's a terribly insensitive, cruel statement. Because the fact is that that may be true. Many of these men and women were sexually abused when they were children 20, 30, 40 years ago. They carry those scars today. They're still disturbed. They're still suffering. And they're still waiting for someone to show them some compassion and some love and some care. I have spent the past 25 years intensely involved with victims, and I can tell you that no one goes through any form of sexual abuse or molestation that doesn't carry lifelong scars. So for these people to say these are old cases, they're insignificant, that makes about as much sense as saying to someone, look, your legs were cut off in an accident. The driver says he's sorry, so why don't you just, you know, go home and they'll grow back. It's insane to even think that. So it is close to the Vatican, and I think what we're seeing is an exposure, and there'll be much more scrutiny of the system itself, which is necessary. All this back and forth that the Pope didn't know, he did know, he didn't know. That's one level of the argument, and of course, I mean, he was the only one who could make a decision to transfer a priest as a bishop of a diocese, so he had to know. And in the Vatican, in the CDF, when he was the prefect there, even though his signature was not on some of these documents, that's not the important point. The point is that he was the one that made the final decision and had to allow it to happen. So the issue is now, it's at the top, and I believe, if nothing else, it will attract the attention of the worldwide nature of this. It's been buried in a number of countries, but it's starting to come out, as we have seen. And the most important people in all of this are the men and women who have been harmed. And if nothing else, this will enable a number of them, many of them, to find the courage to come forward and find the beginning of some healing and some help.
The two critical issues that take us as close to the Vatican as the issue has got thus far is the case of the priest, Father Peter Hullemann, in Munich, where Ratzinger was archbishop, and even though after he left the position in Munich, the suggestion is he would have been aware of what happened to Hullemann and did nothing about it, and did nothing to actually intervene in the issue and stop the guy going back into a position where he later became again accused of molesting children and was finally removed from his position. The other case is the story of Lawrence Murphy in Milwaukee, which erupted again this week, accused of abusing 200 deaf kids. And despite the recommendations of two bishops, including Rembrandt Weakland, the Vatican chose to do nothing. Now, these go direct to Benedict himself. Is there here a failure, or is there a deliberate cover-up, or a failure on his part, or the Vatican's part, to recognize the nature of the issue?
You hit the point right on the head. It's the failure to recognize the extremely grave nature of this issue. And what I find really scandalous is the concentration now is on defending the Pope at all costs. So his supporters among the laity, at least in this country, are coming up with arguments and defenses that are more and more irrational and shrill. The Vatican itself is, issuing all these denials and blame shifting and everything else. But the point is, as you said, the point is that this is bringing it much closer to the system itself. And by system, I mean the hierarchical governmental system, which lives in this clerical estate, the clerical subculture in the Catholic Church, which falsely believes that priests and bishops and cardinals and popes are in a class by themselves. They are better than lay people, and they deserve deference and preferential treatment from lay people, and that it's better to sacrifice some harm to lay people than to taint one of these sacred persons. That's heresy.
At the heart of the nature of the priesthood is the idea that the priest is in some way changed when he becomes a priest. The technical term is ontologically changed. That is, he becomes a different being, a different sort of creature. This is foundational to the whole nature of the Church. This is not going to be changed.
Well, ironically, that could be, because that theology, that concept of the priesthood, has some historical roots, but they're quite shallow. They only go back a couple centuries. That notion that once you're ordained, something mystical happens and you're different. If you ask that of priests the first few centuries, they look at you like you had three heads. So that is something that's a strain of theology that's not de fide. It's not something you absolutely have to believe. I don't particularly believe it at all, that there's anything specially different about me after ordination than there was before. And I think that the whole concept reached its peak in a way in that very, you know, unique period in the 17th and 18th centuries, when in the 19th centuries, when all this mystical approach to what the priesthood was all about. You read the writings of St. John Vianney, for example. He says, you know, if he met a priest and an angel, he'd kneel before the priest first. Well, you know, that's a little too poetic. It's very unrealistic. I mean, if you look at the way life is led, it just simply doesn't cut it. So I think ontologically, in the ecclesiological question is a big one. But I believe you start with what is the consummate nature of the church as defined by the Vatican Council, for example, the body of Christ, the people of God. And then go back a little more in history and determine the issue of the monarchical hierarchical structure and do some honest scriptural exegesis and don't, you know, give the answers before you have the questions laid out and examined.
What you're going to, though, is something that is intensely difficult for the Church to deal with for deeply historic reasons. It goes to the very nature of the way the Church conceives itself as being structured and ordered in the world. You're dealing not just with a regulation, you're dealing with an entire edifice. It's almost like sort of pulling out the capstone of the arch when you deal with the nature of the priesthood, because it involves the ecclesiology, the ordering of the entire church. This is a very, very deep issue. It is something that is said to have been given by God.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. It is extremely deep. And I think the reason that it's very shocking, it's very deep to even say these things. For example, I don't believe that there is any really solid, credible evidence that God ever said we have to have a hierarchical church and that the priests and the bishops are to be looked upon as better than anyone else. That's tradition. There's a lot of mythology wrapped in there. But if you look at the other side of the equation, we have this ecclesiastical system that, yeah, it would be mind-blowing to change it, but it's something that needs to be looked at, and some drastic changes need to be made. The Catholic Church is a monarchy. We don't need a monarchy to have the body of Christ.
In reality, what can the Pope do? I mean, there are suggestions this week. I think the Independent newspaper in Britain earlier this week suggested that there may be a special synod of bishops called. But within that framework, what can a synod of bishops do? What would they be likely to do?
Well, they'll just make a lot more hot air. They'll talk, talk, talk. I mean, that's what the victims say. It's just more words. We want action. What could he do practically? I still believe that if he threw away the scripts that those guys give him over there, that his handlers give him, stood up in the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica and said, look, I'm going to say this from my heart. I'm not reading anything. I'm deeply sorry for each and every act of abuse that happened to any of you, and I'm deeply sorry for anything I did in my diocese when I was a bishop or when I was in the CDF that may have caused any harm, and I know I did things that were wrong, and I accept responsibility. And the next thing is put up a list and say, now these are the bishops and the cardinals that are the most egregious offenders, did the worst for covering up. And rather than reward them, as we did with Cardinal Law, with his own palace in Rome, they're going to be fired. That would cause a stir.
That is not likely to happen.
That's not likely to happen at all. But that is something that would make a difference, or even on a smaller scale. Now, the Holy Father did meet with victims, five victims in the United States, and I believe four or five in Australia. That's it. The meetings took about a half an hour total. No opportunity to really listen to them, to get to know them. They were nervous and scared, and I'm sure he was nervous as well. The Holy Father is the Pope. He is not God, so there's nothing prohibiting him from asking to have a number of these people come to the Vatican to sit down with them on a course of a few days, cancel the audiences and all the social stuff that goes on in the meetings. These are the people that the Church has harmed. It's taken their souls away. So if you want to help them, you need to spend some quality time with them. Now, that sounds like an outlandish idea. Well, wait a minute now. Look at what we're talking about. You need to sit down in the Pope does too, with a couple victims and have them describe exactly what happened, what it was like for them to spend a life after this happened to them in fear, and paranoia, in depression, in inability to have relationships, longing for God but feeling that God has rejected them and has been taken away from them. That's the reality of it. And I don't think it's too much to ask for him to do something like that, not just a token gesture where you go and let them kiss your hand and look them in the eye and say, I'm going to pray for you. Well, that means zip. It means nothing. But something real. Something real.
For many people, something real means financial restitution as well. You keep getting, albeit ill-informed, calls in the media for, you know, the church to sacrifice large amounts of its untold wealth in these issues. Now, that has been an approach that has been able to take effect in places like the United States. In other countries, the law is structured as such that the church can't be held guilty for abuse by individual clergy. Some countries are actually moving ahead of the Vatican and beginning to change the law in their own countries to allow the church to be sued. This may prompt some action from the church?
I believe it will. I've been, you know, as you know, deeply involved in the legal end over here. The people here, and this needs to be made clear, when the first lawsuit started in the United States back in the 80s, the individuals, now almost all of the victims and their families, were devout, obedient, docile Catholics. That's how these priests got at these kids. They got to know the families. They moved in, did some grooming. Now, these men and women had no desire to harm the Catholic Church, to hurt the Pope, to do anything like that, but they reached a point of complete frustration. Why? Because they had gone to the church. They had been rebuffed. They had been ignored. Their phone calls had not been answered, or when they did get answered, they'd receive intimidation not to go public, to keep it quiet. You saw the example in Ireland. The two boys were forced to sign an oath of secrecy. That's what forced these individuals to, at least on a whim, let's go talk to a lawyer. And they found more sympathy from the lawyer than they wanted to be acknowledged and be believed, and he did. And that's where it all started. And since then, most of the victims have found the only way they can get anything resembling some satisfaction. And what many of them have said to me, all I want is to be able to get this out there publicly, to be acknowledged that it really happened, that this really happened, and that something will be done about this priest so that he'll never be able to do this to children again. Because time and again, bishops have made this promise, he'll never be near kids again. And then 6-8 months later, the first family who was abused said, well, we know Father's so-and-so is over here in this parish or in that parish. They lied to us. They didn't keep their promise. And that's the frustration that has forced the approaches to the civil courts. And, of course, the monetary awards in the United States are getting higher and higher and higher. And one of the reasons is because of the frustration that the victims and their attorneys have with the way the churches deal with them once they get into the court environment. They literally pound these people into the ground with stonewall tactics, with threats, with all kinds of treatment like that. And I have been present at the questioning of victims by the lawyers for the church, and it has been a disgusting, disgusting experience to see them, the way they've treated these poor people. I've seen victims reduced to tears, go into catatonic states because of the way they're questioned, as if it was all their fault. And the purpose, of course, is to save the institution's reputation and money. And you know, the bishops, when they're asked about this, say, well, that's the lawyers doing their thing. We have no control over them. Well, yes, you do. You hired them. You have a lot of control.
The church has to face its future. Benedict has, in some senses, the church in his hands. The church has to preserve itself as an institution, yet Benedict has to preserve the church for the faithful as a holy institution. He must be in a situation, trying to be sympathetic to him, of seeing himself having a devil's choice to make here.
I do have more sympathy for him than I did for his predecessor. I do believe that his expressions of sensitivity and sympathy for these men and women are sincere. I don't believe he ever realized just how horrendous this is until fairly recently. But at the same time, I do understand, I guess, the dilemma, but the church is people. It's not buildings. It's not stock portfolios. It's not beautiful robes and stained glass windows. If a diocese goes flat out insolvent and has to sell every building it has, it still is the church because the people are there. If they want to gather around and rally around the mission of Christ and do good for one another, then the church is there. It's always been started in any mission country with people, not with buildings. You know, you get the people first, then you put the buildings up. But I think he's part of the system. He grew up in that whole system, so his tendency is going to be to protect the bishops and the papacy, because to them, that is the whole church. That's it. I don't approve of that tendency at all. I believe that the people are the church, and you know, the bishops are not more important than the people who've been harmed. They're less important. And if somebody's going to be sacrificed, it should be them, and not these innocent people whose lives have been and their souls have been ripped out of them by sexual abuse.
Tom Doyle, you remain loyal to the church in its broadest sense. You've faced 25, 30 years of working with this. You maintain your stance with the victims. Where does this end for you? What would be an adequate resolution for you of this issue? You've said the Pope must stand with the victims, but he would see himself as already having done that. What you're suggesting is something far more thoroughgoing, that is, a reform of the entire priestly structure, of the nature of the priesthood. These are things that are going to take far more than a generation to implement. Where finally for you is an outcome here, a satisfactory outcome that you can see as being realistic?
I would say an acknowledgement that these issues need to be deeply, deeply studied, and ridding the church, the institutional church, of the fear to even look at them, knowing full well that it's very, very risky, because it's going to mean possibly the disintegration of the system that has provided the support and the identity for a lot of the leadership, that it's going to change the monarchy and return it to what the Lord intended and what the earliest church really was. For me, what I would love to see is an attitude throughout the Catholic Church on the part of bishops and priests, that it was clear that they were so immensely concerned about victims that whenever they heard about it, they would drop their meetings and playing golf or whatever it was and go to them and embrace them and listen to them. That's rarely been done, rarely been done in my 25 years of experience. Mostly it's, you know, they just don't do it. And when bishops in our country have had to meet with victims, it's been forced on them by the lawyers. I'm not so naive and childish in that I think that there will be drastic change. But where we are today is light years away from where I ever expected the church would be or the society would be 25 years ago when I first became involved.
Dragged kicking and screaming into the light.
It is. That's true. And my primary concern has always been the men and women who've been harmed, because I know them. I know them. I know many of them. They're close friends of mine. They're acquaintances. And another dimension of this that's equally important, I think, are the mothers and fathers. I've spent a lot of time with mothers and fathers listening, both in the United States and in Ireland and in Canada. And I'll tell you, there's nothing for me that has been more gut-wrenching and painful than listening to a mother and a father pour out their hearts and describe what it was like for them, or try to describe, because there really aren't any words that are adequate that reach the depth of the pain, what it was like when they first found out that their little boy or their little girl had been molested by a man that they trusted totally, by a priest. It's bad enough that this happens to their children, but when they found out it was a priest, it sends a shock through that cannot be compared to anything.
Tom Doyle, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Let's finish then with some sacred music by the great cellist Pablo Casals. O vos omnes, you who pass by, see if there is any sorrow like my sorrow.
Thank you.
This has been a Good Friday special program on ABC Local Radio. Join me, John Cleary, later on tonight for more music and mystery of Good Friday. Coming up shortly, the news.